My name is Robert Reeford, and I'm Executive Director of the Canadian Institute of International Affairs. I'm talking to Dr. David Hopper, the President of the International Development Research Center, its first president, who's held that office now for, what, 7 years since it was set up in 1970. And what were you doing before that?
Bob, I was with the Rockefeller, before that the Ford Foundations in India. Before that, I was in academia, teaching at the University of Chicago. I got interested in India back in the early 50s, and I spent 2 years living in a mud village on the Ganges Plain from 53 to 55, where I actually did some farming. I came back to Canada and Chicago, then returned to India in the early 60s, with the Ford Foundation, and then with the Rockefeller Foundation. I'm known as the Foundation Hopper. then came to the IDRC when it was established in 1970.
But during the time you were in India, you were mainly working in the field of agriculture and food.
I was working primarily on the issues surrounding the raising of food production in India, more broadly in Asia. Asia was the beat. I worked with the Asian Development Bank and in the Philippines and in Thailand and in several other countries, although I continued to hold my base in India.
And I understand that as of the 1st of January 1978, you will be joining the World Bank in Washington.
That's correct.
Now, the World Bank, that's officially the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, to give it its full title?
Yes, there's a group, actually. There's a World Bank group. There's the IBRD, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. There's the International Finance Corporation, and there's the International Development Association, or IDA. These three different entities cluster under the broad title of the World Bank. And my responsibilities there, starting January, will be as Vice President for the South Asia region, which is India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Burma, so on.
And the World Bank is concerned with aid, development, assistance, that kind of general area.
World Bank, not
a bank in the sense of the Toronto Dominion Bank around the corner.
No, the World Bank was established at the close of the Second World War, primarily to act as an international financier of reconstruction and development, then of the war-torn European countries. It has gone on since then, with the assistance of its member nations, to provide a major source of funding to the development of mainly the developing countries of the world.
Okay, now before we actually start talking about the world's food problems, just a word perhaps about the IDRC, of which you are now the president. What was this set up to do and what is it doing?
Well, it grew out of a trend in aid, which in the late 60s began to focus on the problems of science and technology. How did you move technologies from the Western industrial countries to the developing countries? How did you develop appropriate technologies in these countries for their environments and circumstances? The Rockefeller and Ford Foundations had a large experience on this, going back to the 50s, when they began working on agricultural research in the developing countries, and they had actually established several research centers, the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, a institute for work on wheat and maize in Mexico, and so on. These institutes began producing high-yielding varietal materials suited to the tropics and the subtropical regions of the world.
The so-called Green Revolution?
The so-called Green Revolution, that's right. And the government of Canada at the time, Mr. Pearson particularly, he was prime minister, was interested in these moves by the two great foundations in the U.S., to assist the developing countries move technologies developed elsewhere or to invent or research technologies for their own activities. So he proposed at a speech at Carleton University that Canada establish what is basically the equivalent of a foundation to be financed by a parliamentary grant, an annual grant. And this foundation came into being as the International Development Research Center in May 1970. Mr. Pearson was its first chairman. I was asked by the then director of external aid in Canada, the director of CETA, Maurice Strong, if I would be the president. I was very pleased to accept, and we launched the IDRC. I might say that in the years since, it has been one of the outstanding institutions worldwide in the work in science and technology. Our budget now is larger than the Rockefeller Foundation budget, and it approaches the Ford Foundation budget for overseas activities. So that the IDRC is a major actor in this international field of application of science and technology to development.
Well, I'd like to come back in a little while to talk perhaps more about some of the projects that IDRC has been doing. But I'd like to start perhaps by looking at what I think we are all now beginning to realize more and more is a major problem, the problem of food. Are we going to have enough food? Perhaps I could throw at you a quotation from a speech that you made in Japan early in 1977. You said, "World food production today sits on the knife edge of instability. North American farming can meet reasonable food deficits in the short-term future, but a repeat of the droughts of 1972 or even the Asian crop failures of 1965-67 would severely strain global food supplies. In the long run, not even North America would be able to keep abreast of food demand." Now, were you being a bit alarmist there? Were you being a devil's advocate, or were you painting a true picture?
No, I think it's a true picture. It's not a picture that can't be altered. And the plea in that particular piece, as in other of my writings, has been to recognize that we have a very vast potential in the world for increasing world food production. But as yet, we're not tapping that potential, and it's going to take time to tap it. Now, at the present time, the populations of the developing countries represent about two-thirds of mankind. They produce less than one-third of man's food. By the year 2000, if population trends continue, and I'm not an alarmist on population, I believe we can feed them much, much larger populations, and I already see signs of slackening in population growth in many countries. India, for example, has dropped her birth rate from about 42 per thousand to about 38 per thousand, and this is a major shift. But if population trends continue, we will be in the year 2000 with roughly three-quarters of the world's population in the developing countries. This is between the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer and on the edges of the tropics. And they'll still be producing, if present projections hold, less than 30% of the world's food. Now, on that basis, we have a very severe food imbalance. And it will either mean that the developed countries are going to have to transport and ship more food to the developing countries, probably on some sort of concessional terms, because these people do not have the foreign exchange to pay for it, or we're going to have to raise production in the developing countries. Now, the drought of 1972, which was a worldwide drought, it affected northern Latin America, it affected North Africa and the Sahelian zone of Africa, the sub-Saharan zone of Africa. It went right on through China, India, Thailand, Southeast Asia, and the Soviet Union. This is what caused the big run on the grain stock supplies in the United States and Canada. We had 20 million tons of food to meet that world deficit. The world deficit was about 40 million tons, metric tons of food. A similar circumstance today, not when I wrote that piece, but a similar circumstance today could be met because, again, Canada and the U.S. have had bumper harvests and we have built up our reserves. But the difference between today and 1972 is that in 1972 there were 60 million acres of land in the soil bank in the United States. That 60 million acres is now under plow. And we are now pushing against the capacity of the temperate zone to produce food. Oh, we can increase it 3-4% per annum for a while. But we are going to run out of the capacity of the developed countries, the North American, European breadbaskets to produce food. If the Soviet Union should have another drought, and the Soviet Union is much more vulnerable to weather than either Canada, the United States, or Western Europe, if the Soviet Union should have another drought, if there was a repeat of the circumstances of 1972, or a significant failure of the rains as occurred in the mid-60s throughout the broad reaches of South and Southeast Asia, I'm not sure how long we in North America, Western Europe, could continue to meet the food needs of a growing population in the developing countries. Now, that said, my concern is that the developing countries should be the big food producers, not the residual food producers. They have the sunlight, they have the water, they have a year-round growing temperature, they can grow 3-4 crops in sequence, one after the other, which we cannot do in Canada, or in the plains of Kansas or Nebraska, or in Western Europe. And it is the lag in their agricultural development that has been my major concern.
So we, in a sense, have reached, well, very close to reaching capacity in terms of what we can produce, and in order to feed the world's population, it is the developing countries, the tropical countries, that have got to produce more food.
Certainly within the next two decades, there's got to be a larger increase in food output from the developing countries if they are going to sustain the meet the growing population demands and the rising demands due to income. The developing countries are developing. They are having rising income, and as the incomes rise, they demand more food.
Can they do it? I suppose, in a sense, you can divide this into two things. Can they do it physically, and can they do it financially?
All right. Technically, it can be done. There needs to be more research, and so on. The issue is resources. Let's just take a drive through our rural areas and take a look at the network of roads, the network of service facilities, of machinery depots, of supply facilities, of milk pickup points, of packing plants, and so on and so forth, that are all part of our agriculture. Then drive through India, where the roads may be 30, 40 miles apart, where there are none of these facilities, where villages are deep in the interior, long walking distances. The roads don't exist, the facilities don't exist, the processing, the storage, all the paraphernalia of an agricultural economy does not exist. Now, that is what has to be built in the developing countries if they are going to pursue their agricultural potential, if they're going to build a modern agriculture and really tap the resources, sunlight, soil that they have. To do that is going to take colossal amounts of money, and they do not have the resources. The Sahel is a very good example. This is the countries just south of the Sahara. It's Senegal, Mali, Niger, across the transhumic zone. It's a semi-arid zone. There are five rivers in the Sahel. They've had desperate droughts in the past 6 years. They have another drought this year in Senegal, although not in Mali and Niger. There are five rivers and a very large lake, the Lake Chad Basin. Each one of these rivers could be tapped. They could greatly increase the land that they have available for under irrigation to produce the kind of crops that they need. The six Sahelian nations, Chad, Niger, Mali, Senegal, Mauritania, Upper Volta, among them have about $2 billion worth of gross national product. It's a ridiculously small gross national product. It's less than the profits of General Motors Corporation. Now, that's their total gross national product. To develop the five rivers and the Lake Chad Basin would take something like $30 billion. Now, for these countries to say we're going to embark upon that development scheme with a GNP that is as small as they have, it's just ludicrous. It'd be like Canada saying with our gross national product at $150 billion that we're going to proceed to develop our north, even although it's going to cost us, say, $1 trillion, $1,000 billion. It won't be done. And they cannot do it. Now, somebody's got to provide these resources if these nations are going to be brought to the point of feeding themselves. And my only point is that if the industrial countries can afford to put what we put into lipsticks and into a wide range of other of our goods, surely we can afford a very, very small proportion of our total gross national product annually to assist the Sahelian nations. Spread over 30 years, the $30 billion at $1 billion a year, it's a very, very small amount of money.
That's true. But now here you are talking about one particular area of the world. There are other areas of the world that surely face similar problems.
All right. Let's take India. And exactly the same thing that can be said. The Ganges, Brahmaputra, Indus basins that border on India and Bangladesh is certainly one of the world's greatest untapped agricultural resources. At the present time, it's populated by 120 million people. Well, more than that, it's about 320 million people. That resource, if tapped with modern agriculture, present technology, could almost double present world food output. There's 100 million acres of this resource in India alone. It could be made to produce about 10 tons to the acre. That's 1 billion tons of food grain, and total world food production at the present time is about 1.2 billion tons of world food grains. To do it would require harnessing the rivers in Nepal. It would require building large irrigation structures on the Ganges Plain. And it would require an investment of, say, $50 billion. But for an investment over the next 25 years of approximately $100, $150 billion, and these are very rough estimates, but I don't think that they're either conservative or low of the mark. too low of the mark. I think we could provide food security for both the populations of the year 2000 and possibly for the populations of the year 2050, when I do see population definitely beginning to level off, mankind having a total population of around 15, 16 billion people, compared with our present 4 billion. There's no question we can feed these people with a vast abundance, but it does take the investment. I think we've got 25, 50 years to lay the groundwork for it, but we must begin now. Otherwise, we're going to face crises in a decade, 15 years, 20 years hence.
Okay, so it's technically feasible. I can't argue with you on that. I know I'm not an expert in these things. Why isn't it being done? You've been talking about vast sums of money, so obviously this is in itself a problem.
All right. I think there are three reasons. In the first place, the food resources of the world have been sufficient to tide all of mankind through. We've lived in a remarkable period. There has not been a major famine in the world since 1942. Now, there is no other period of almost 35 years of world's history where we can identify no major, really major famine.
Really?
Absolutely. You go back on the history, 1908, 1903 in China, 1908 in India, and so on, right up when you number deaths, millions, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million people. We haven't had it. We haven't had it because the grain reserves of the North American continent, Australia, Argentina, have underpinned the drought, periodic recurrence of drought, in these large population countries. With that, there has been a lack of urgency. In 1972, we saw a rise in the urgency. We got the land bank plowed under. We were talking about food shortages. In 1974, we held a world food conference, and so on. In 1977, we suddenly have a rise in production in Canada and the United States, good years, and everybody is now beginning to sit back and saying, well, maybe we got into too much of a panic on the food situation. It'll look after itself. This recurrent cycle has occurred in the 50s and in the 60s of alternate concern and then complacency. And as long as that cyclic pattern is there, not only in our country, but in the developing countries as well, the urgency is off the developing countries and our country to provide assistance on food. We can give food aid away now. Mr. Whelan would really love to get rid of some of the wheat that sits on the prairies. That recurrent cycle just saps energy. That's one reason. We're not pushing. The developing countries are not pushing. The food is there. A second reason is that the developing countries themselves have very limited resources. Revolutions are not made in the countryside, or only rarely made in the countryside. Revolutions basically occur in cities. This is where the coups occur. This is where the troubles occur. And the urban industrial complex has attracted the bulk of the investment of the developing countries. They are concerned with building their industries. They are concerned with the modernity of the cities. And they have neglected their agriculture. China's a possible exception on this. Tanzania is an exception. But most countries have been very neglectful of investments in their own agricultures. This is a second reason why we have not seen a shift on it. And nations are very slow to shift their priorities in this particular area. The third reason primarily has to do with the costs involved. That you cannot embark on a $10 million Sahelian project. For $10 million, you buy nothing. That it's, you either have, these are lumpy investments. It's like building a pipeline. You can't put $10 million into the northern pipeline. You've got to put $9 billion or you put nothing. And equally so in the Sahel. You've either got to alter the course of the rivers, dam them, control them, so that one feeds to the next reservoir and so on and out through the irrigation channels, or you don't touch the rivers. That there's no partway measure. There's no just little bit. And no agency, not even the World Bank, has yet been able to muster the resources necessary to mount these very high-cost, expensive programs. And until the governments of the world are willing to stand back and say, yes, we're all going to pitch in and cooperate, we're not going to get it done. The engineers can talk about it. I can talk about it. We can build dream castles in the air. But it's going to take far more than just the Canadian government or the U.S. government or the World Bank or the West German government. It's going to take them all collectively to say, this is where we put our priorities, this is where we put our resources, and we'll follow it through. That has not yet been done.
And this presumably brings up what I would call the political factor. I mean, who are we
rich, wealthy industrial sitting in North America to tell the people of the Sahel that this is what you should do with your rivers and this is the way you should change your life.
All right, but the Sahelian countries have formed, along with Canada and with other nations, an organization known as the Club des Amis du Sahel. It's a club of the Friends of the Sahel. Now, the Club des Amis is centered on Paris. It is a joint club of the six Sahelian nations plus interested donor countries, and it has most of the industrial countries. And they have come through with a plan to be financed in the Sahel. As yet, the wealthy countries have not responded as a bloc to that plan. But there is no doubt in my mind as to the priority that the Sahelian nations give to accomplishing this plan if the money is provided. And I think now it's a question of how we work the negotiations, and there'll be long, tough negotiations. But in the end, I think we'll come through. I'm an optimist in this regard.
Well, good for you. I mean, again, to throw another quotation at you from one of your recent annual reports, you said, and I quote, on the 26th of March 1976, the world's population was officially estimated to have passed the 4 billion mark. The world's food reserves were estimated at a perilously low 31 days' supply. That means that in the event of a worldwide drought resulting in large-scale crop failures, millions of people would starve, most of them in the Third World. You've just been painting this picture. But, you know, 31 days' supply of food, I suppose, doesn't sound too bad if we think of it in terms of what we may have in our freezer and our kitchen at home. But I suppose in the overall global context, it's fantastically little.
Well, that's more of a publicity figure than a real figure. We were down to 31 days food supply. That is the officially estimated stocks. But we're well up again now. We're probably, normally the world is carried between 60 and 90 days food supply, and actually that's about where we've returned to. I think that we were close at that time, that had another drought hit us in 74, I think food prices would have climbed right through the roof, and many in the developing countries would not have been assured of an adequate supply to sustain life.
What happened to the Green Revolution that you talked about a moment ago? Wasn't this hailed as the great hope for mankind?
Well, it was by those who weren't involved in it. In fact, it's affected a very, very small postage stamp area of the world. It more than doubled wheat production in India. It greatly increased rice production in the Philippines and in Thailand. It increased wheat production throughout North Africa and in Turkey. It made Mexico food self-sufficient, these new high-yielding varieties. But the high-yielding varieties take a large amount of water. You can't get the extra plant material that makes the high yield without feeding it water. And it takes a lot of nutrient, a lot of fertilizer. And those things have to come together. Now, the fertilizer implies fertilizer supply lines. It implies that farmers are in the cash market. It means that they're going to reach out and buy their fertilizer with money. That means they've got to sell their crop. And we're back to that whole infrastructure of support services, of markets, of elevators, of places to bring the grain to, of transport systems and so on, that the developing countries lack. So that for many of the developing countries, the Green Revolution varieties, these new high-yielding materials of wheat and rice and sorghums and maize and so on, would make a terrific difference to them. But they do not have the infrastructure supporting the decision by the farmer to move to the modern agriculture. And it's that infrastructure that's got to be built.
Can we transfer modern agriculture from our society as we know it to the developing world? I mean, you think of a prairie farm that has maybe thousands of acres and is run by one family with a bunch of tractors. But surely when you go to the developing country, you've got to have far more individuals. You've got to follow the Chinese model of lots of peasants working little plots, haven't
you?
Sure,
but what we may not transfer is the high productivity per worker which we have in our agriculture. We may follow what the Japanese have done and what you suggest the Chinese have done, and that is a very high productivity per acre. Our productivity per acre in Canada is really very low compared with Japan. We're producing just a little over a metric ton per hectare on our Western grain farms. In Japan, you're producing between 6 and 7 metric tons per hectare of rice. Now, they're very small farms in Japan. Very few of them are over 2 hectares. In size, 5 acres. But they have put the inputs in, the intensive agriculture, the intensive labor that goes to producing a very high yield per hectare. And that's the route the developing countries have to go. And in the sense that modern farm technology, based on science-based technologies, is what made our farming in Canada productive, it is the same basis for technology that will make farming in India or the Philippines or Indonesia or Brazil or Colombia or the Sahel productive. But the organization of agriculture, the economic organization, size of farm, numbers of farmers, the location of markets and so on, will be quite different in these countries from what it is in Canada. The productivity will be productivity per acre rather than productivity per worker, which we've stressed in the Canadian-American context.
So one of the things we can help them with is with the transport, the communications.
We can help them with the building of the infrastructure. We can help them with the scientific research. This is where the IDRC is basically operating at the present time. We are financing research in the developing countries. Now, we made one mistake years ago. We believed that a wheat farmer from Saskatchewan or from Kansas or from Texas could go out to India and tell those Indian farmers how to farm better. This is what I did when I was in the village. I farmed 6 acres of wheat. I spent 2 years at it. And both years, and I think I'm a pretty good wheat farmer, I'm an agricultural graduate and so on. In both years, I just was at the bottom of the yield scale in my village. My village cultivators just licked me all hollow.
No,
as they should have. They were just better farmers. They knew their soils, they knew their climate, they knew their conditions. I didn't. Well, for example, wheat in India is planted in November and you harvest in March. It means that the temperature cools down through the wheat cycle. You've got to get it on when the ground gets cool enough for the wheat to germinate. Then it goes down through a cool cycle, and then it warms up and you have to get it off before it gets too hot in the summer heat. In Canada, we're just the reverse. We have to wait till the ground warms up enough to germinate the wheat. Then we take it through a warm cycle, and we have to get it off before it gets too cold to freeze the wheat. Now, those farmers knew that cycle. I didn't. I really had to learn it the hard way, and I never did become an accomplished wheat farmer. But what we eventually brought to India, that is through the foundation, the work of the foundations, through the work of technical assistance and so on, was a set of research technologies which went into the research stations in these countries, new varietal materials, biological materials, new techniques of handling their soil, and we tested these out and discovered how to increase yields of wheat by factors of, 50, 60, 80, doubled, even tripled in some cases, over what their traditional yields were. And this is what founded the Green Revolution. It was the adaptive research. It was the research in their environment to discover techniques that were adapted to that environment and useful in that environment that was important. We could not import them from Saskatchewan or Kansas. We had to do the work there. And this is why so much of agricultural research has to be done that way. Now, you know, bus techniques of transportation, mass transportation in the city can be picked up from one city and moved to another city. A bus is a bus is a bus. But a wheat crop is not a wheat crop is not a wheat crop. It's not the same in Saskatchewan as it is in India.
Now, I take it then that this kind of thing is exactly what the IDRC is doing at the present time.
It is what the IDRC does with its resources. We finance research in the developing countries by developing country scholars. We expose them to research technologies worldwide. We assist them in the transfers of these research technologies to their research environments, and then we finance their conduct of that research. They put money in, we put money in. But we provide them with whatever small equipment is required. We assist their governments in making the resources available to permit that kind of research to take place. We do it in a wide range of crops, root crops, legumes. We'd even do it in fish farming, which we've had some very significant breakthroughs on.
And then having provided the resources to undertake this research, it's then up to the government.
It is then up to agencies like CETA, the World Bank, and so on to come in with the large amounts of money that are necessary to get those techniques spread among farmers. The new dwarf wheats that underpinned the Green Revolution, so-called, that Norman Borlaug, Dr. Borlaug of the Rockefeller Foundation working in Mexico, received the Nobel Peace Prize for in 1970, those dwarf wheats cost perhaps the Rockefeller Foundation maybe $10 million to develop over 20 years. When they came into India, it was a very cheap transfer. We just grew them, we multiplied it, the seed went out to the cultivators. But it cost the government of India $280 million the first year that we had a big crop of this to buy the fertilizer necessary for those crops. And that is where the big money boys have to come into it. Now India has built many, many fertilizer plants to provide an indigenous supply of fertilizer. But these plants are, you're talking $500, $600 million, $1 billion for a single fertilizer plant. And so that there needs to be, accompanying the technology, a very heavy investment in these infrastructures of supply to the farmer to back him up as he picks up this research. Research is small potatoes, and that's what the IDRC is, $35, $40 million a year. But the movement of that research into use by cultivators takes very large investments.
There must be some things that you've done that you're proud of, some success stories.
Well, my work in the Indian village in the early 50s convinced me, after visiting all the research stations in India, that the problem was not the Indian farmer. He was not stubborn to change. He hadn't been doing this for 1,000 years and therefore wouldn't alter. Matter of fact, I never met a 1,000-year-old farmer. The issue that the Indian farmer was confronted with is that he had no technology that was profitable for him to adopt. When I came back to Canada and worked with the Ford Foundation on the side, I kept pressing this view, and eventually the Rice Institute was formed, and the wheat program in Mexico, which the Rockefeller Foundation had launched earlier, was brought into an international prominence. I returned to India to watch this research develop on the research plots, and then move out to the cultivators. And the cultivators adopted it far faster than the Canadian cultivators. It took us 7 years to get hybrid corn spread reasonably well in the province of Ontario. It took only 3 years to gobble up all the irrigated wheat acreage in India with the dwarf varieties of wheat. They were crying for new technologies, new systems of farming, new techniques of farming. Today, India more than doubled its wheat production from what it was in 1966. India now produces 50% more wheat than Canada, and wheat is not their most important crop. Rice is. And we're doing, seeing exactly the same thing occur in the rice area of agricultural production. In the rice regions, more and more of the modern technologies are spreading, and more yields, higher yields per hectare of rice are being attained.
Well, is India reaching the point of self-sufficiency in food?
India now has a huge surplus in stock. She has over 20 million tons of food grain in her buffer stock at the present time. India could sustain a very substantial drought and feed herself from her own resources. This has been the story of the last 3 years. Droughts in South Asia tend to come in 2 years in a row. Should she get 2 years in a row, I think she could carry herself through by past record. But if the population continues to grow, India is adding the equivalent of the population of Australia each year, 13 million, 14 million people each year to its 620 million now. If that population continues to grow, agriculture in India has to grow faster than it's been growing over the past decade, even with the Green Revolution. To do that, we have to unlock other areas of India into which the new technology of these high-yielding techniques of farming can filter. For that, it means a very large investment. Let me just use an example. The Mahanadi River drains eastward from the central plain of India, just south of the city of Calcutta. It drains down through a place called Cuttack. It's a big estuary. At the present time, that river produces, or that riverine area, produces about 3 million tons of rice. With an expenditure, and the plans are all there, we have the engineering drawings and so on and so forth, and indeed the World Bank has agreed to underwrite a part of it. But with an expenditure of about $1 billion over the course of the next 10 years on that Mahanadi Delta, rice production could be increased from 3 million tons of rice to about 10 million tons of rice. That extra 7 million tons of rice in 1 year would be worth about $1.4 billion at the present price of rice, $200 a ton on the world market. So India pays off the investment in 1 year's increase in production. It's a question of how India gets the $1 billion for that purpose. India's gross national product at the present time is about $80 billion a year. She's got welfare programs. She's got a whole lot of things to spend what little government revenue she can collect and taxes on. And it's a question of where does she get the billion. At the present time, the government of India's contribution to this activity is held up for just a lack of tax revenue in India to pay for it. Eventually, we'll get the project going. As I say, I'm an optimist. But it's got to come fairly soon because for this kind of a project, it does take 10 years. You can't rush it in a year or two. It's a lot of construction work and so on. It's kind of like it takes 9 months for a woman to produce a baby, and nine women are not going to produce in 1 month. So that when you turn to this type of activity, you have this kind of a lead time to realize the full fruits from the project investment.
Now, are there unforeseen consequences to these kind of large-scale projects? I mean, I seem to remember hearing that the Aswan Dam that was built in Egypt has had all kinds of consequences that nobody anticipated.
Well, I think that you'll find that most of the Egyptian scientists anticipated the consequences of the Aswan Dam and discussed them quite freely. They were not, Nasser was determined to go ahead with the Aswan Dam, and perhaps not enough attention was paid to the consequences question in the investment that was made. Governments tend to be reluctant to put the full investment that's necessary. I think in the Mahanadi case that I've cited in India, the $1 billion includes the drains and so on that traditionally have been slighted and were slighted in the case of the Aswan Dam. The Aswan Dam has had really only one consequence that I'm aware of that was not fully predicted, and that was the increase in the incidence of schistosomiasis or bilharzia, which is a parasitic disease carried by snails along the riverbank. They're infected by humans. The parasite is incubated in the snails. It is deposited back in the water from the feces of the snails, and it enters the human body again, and it's a debilitating disease. The former silt that used to be carried down the river used to kill the snails, drive a lot of them out. With the control of the water, so that the water flow no longer carries this huge flood of silt each year, the snail population has arisen. That was not anticipated. But the salinization problem, the loss of the fisheries, and so on and so forth that occurred with the Aswan were anticipated, and have to be considered as being offset by the power that it made available to Egyptian industry and by the almost 30%, 33% increase in land area that it gave to Egypt. There are consequences, yes. Any act that man has some sort of a consequence, and some of them are deleterious. It's a question of weighing off the benefits against the costs, of trying doing your best to predict consequences, and moving forward when you think the consequences can be offset or can be accepted because of the other benefits that would be gained. On the Mahanadi question, I'm not sure what the consequences would be. I don't think they would be substantial, providing the drainage is there. If it's not there, then we may have some real soil problems, waterlogging problems of the kind that have occurred in the Punjab since the British began putting in canals without putting in drains.
Now, what about Canada, David? What has Canada been doing, and what can Canada do?
Well, Canada has had a foreign aid policy, which the IDRC is a part of it, I think a very proud part for Canada. We certainly have led the world in the most innovative institution, and every country that I'm aware of, Australia, West Germany, Sweden, now the U.S., and so on, have suggested also building an IDRC. The Canadians have been very daring in the IDRC. These other countries have not been so daring, and we haven't seen the equivalent established yet, but I think we will in the future. Canada in 1950 put a lot of investment into infrastructure, power projects, and so on. This was Canada's big push. In the 1960s, Canada worked very hard on universities, on teaching, on building human capital, human skills, as well as continuing its work in infrastructure, transport, and so on. In the late 60s, Canada climbed on the science and technology bandwagon, and the IDRC was the result, and I think a successful one. Today, Canada is now getting into the issue that is current in foreign aid circles, of how do we make sure that the aid we give, that the benefits from it begin to filter through to the lowest members of the population, really the poorest people, not just captured by the urban elites or by the political elites. I'm not sure how we go about this because there are some very delicate issues in terms of the invasion of the sovereign nature of countries. But I think that the foreign aid community will begin to come to grips with these issues in the course of the next few years, and Canada will be playing a part of it. My own feeling is that Canada has perhaps been a little too much me too in the foreign aid game, when it could have branched out more aggressively to provide world leadership in particular areas. I use agriculture as an example. I once wrote an article, which I think you have, Bob, on Canada's role in world agricultural development, in which I pointed out that Canada does have a unique position with regard to the developing countries as being a very neutral country. We have no colonial past. We are bilingual. We're a small nation or an intermediate power nation, a wealthy nation. We have a good record in foreign aid and of non-intervention in the affairs of other nations. We have a really superb group of agricultural scientists and agricultural technicians in Canada who are willing and anxious to work on development problems. And I think that if we in Canada had said, look, our concerns are going to be primarily, not exclusively, but primarily, to the problem of feeding hungry nations and hungry people, I think we could have carved ourselves a niche that would have provided far more leadership to the world development community than, in fact, Canada has provided. Saying that, it's a wishful thinking. Canada has played an important role. We are we're not the top in terms of assistance we give to developing countries.
But we have been increasing it in recent years, which is more than you can say of many people.
That's right. We haven't been going the other way, and we've been doing more than the share generally. We're in the upper average group of the industrial nations in what we do assist in the developing countries. And for the most part, the projects that Canada supported in developing countries have been good projects. Oh, there's always the odd dog, but that is a poor project. But that's true in anybody's portfolio.
But now, what you've been saying so far is essentially what government can do. What about the individual Canadian? What can I do?
Well, I think that the individual Canadian can become more aware of the issues facing the developing countries. We are going to face, I think, in the not-too-distant future, and we've already gotten into it with some of our policies now, the trade aid question. Many of the developing countries have skills and have labor forces and have an industrial base that lets them compete at the low end of our consumer goods area. Textiles, ready-made shirts, sneaker shoes, and so on. These do affect Canadian industry. That have been built up in these areas. And Canada has put quotas and embargoes on developing country products, particularly from Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, coming in, as Mr. Davis found out when he was in Hong Kong and they complained to him. We, in fact, may do more harm to the progress of the developing countries when we put these quotas on than we would good by increasing our aid flows to them. This is an opportunity they seek to earn the foreign exchange that will let them buy the wood products and the cement and so on and so forth that are necessary parts of their development. We haven't come to this, but we're not alone. The U.S. is in an even worse position, and West Germany and the European Economic Community Canada's a saint compared with many of their policies with regard to trade with the developing countries. But these are issues that are going to be on the agenda in future. And it's either going to be a very much larger aid transfer, or it's going to be a freer access for the developing countries to Canadian markets in semi-finished and finished industrial products. Not the high technology products, but the lower technology products in the consumer goods field.
And you still remain an optimist?
On the food question, yes. I think that despite the fact that my feeling is the time is short and the time is quickly running out on us, I see moves by more and more of the developing countries and even some of the developed countries to come to an accommodation on this. The only new UN fund created in the 1970s, other than the Environment Organization, and it was a small fund, this is a big fund, was the $1 billion which the nations of the world put up, OPEC and the developed industrial countries, put up for an international fund for agricultural development called EFAD. It's an important initiative. The Club des Amis du Sahel may actually move us into the area where we can get this group investments. My own hope is that the World Bank will be able to put together a consortia that will raise the $1 billion for the Mahanadi for India. The largest untapped reserve in the world for agricultural product is the South Sudan. And here's 200 million hectares of land, which frankly could double world food production if it were tapped. It's beautifully watered, it's flat, it's just an unbelievable agricultural resource. Needs to be drained. The water would go out the Nile River, increase its flow, and permit more agriculture in the lower Sudan, that is northern Sudan, lower on the river, and in Egypt. The South Sudan is being developed by a large inflow of Arab money, particularly Saudi Arabian money from the oil revenues. Hundreds of millions of dollars, about the absorptive capacity of the Sudanese nation at this point, is moving into that country to develop this. So that I think that within 10 years, it is likely that if these trends continue and we don't become too complacent again, that we will see the foundations laid for an agricultural development movement, which is not going to be stopped. It's not the case now, but frankly, I think the IDRC has played a role in this. We're instrumental. We are members of the Club des Amis du Sahel. We assisted in its creation. We are assisting both the Sahelian nations in its activities. We have projects focused on the area that the Mahanadi will be effective in and in other parts of India. We've got agricultural technologies in cassavas and root crops and legumes and better sorghums and so on coming forth to be applied when farmers get the resources that are necessary for them. We have close ties with many of the senior large aid agencies to get the money in to permit these technologies to flow to cultivators and those who would use them. And in that sense, we work very closely with CETA to try to bankroll. They're our big boys down the street. They have a lot of money compared with our little bit. What we pioneer on in the discovery of new relationships and new technologies. I see it being done. I see the groundwork being laid for the trends that will come to fruition, that will begin to push forward. We're a few steps back, but it's one of the things that, frankly, I would not have left Canada for the World Bank if it had not been for an opportunity to work in South Asia. That's what the vice presidency is about. The difference in budget, the IDRC's, this year's budget is about $50 million in terms of projects. Well, the budget at the World Bank is $2 billion for South Asia. And I think that if I can hold the interest of the bank and the interest of the nations and the interest of the contributors to the bank and the interest of the South Asians in the area of food production, that we can move forward with an expectation that the 25 years, the perspective of a generation, that we may indeed begin to approach the issue of world food abundance.
Well, certainly you will face challenging times when you get to the World Bank, David, and I can't think of a man better qualified to face them.
Thank
you
very much
indeed.
Thank you.